listener production.
Hi, this is Paul McIntyre. Welcome to the MI3 Audio Edition. I've been a business journalist for 25 years covering the marketing, media, agency and tech sectors. In this series, we talk to industry leaders about the global and local developments that you need to be across this week. Well, whether you're a marketer or from agency and tech land playing with personalization, segmentation, performance media or brand building, this debate may well mess with you a little. The default position for many, many companies in an economic downturn like we're in is to play the discounting and fire sale card or to deploy more performance-based marketing and messaging tactics. But as this panel of social scientists, marketers and ad agency bosses is about to discuss, there's a massive segment of the population that are high discretionary spenders who don't play like traditional consumer segments and are driving a two-speed economic recovery, as Roy Morgan's CEO, Michelle Levine, said in MI3 last week. So let's unravel this consumer behaviour paradox. With us today is Ross Honeywill, Executive Director at the Centre for Social Economics and the whiz behind this consumer classification called NEOS, or the New Economic Order. Ross, a long time ago, was at KPMG and has been working on understanding the NEO mindset for at least 15 years, I think. Ross is joined by Scott Browning, former marketing director at JB Hi-Fi, now chief customer officer at Jagged, Jonathan Coles, principal at advisory firm Premium, and a former marketing director at Moët Hennessy. And the last but not least is Nick Cleaver, CEO at 303 Mullen Lowe. So welcome, gents. Really looking forward to this one. And Ross, we're going to start with you. You started all this mess, so let's get into it and say, give us a quick overview, Ross, on these NEOs. Who are they? What is different about them? How many are there in Australia? And how much money have they really got? Only about 15 questions for you answering the first one, Ross, and welcome.
The NEOs, as you say, is an acronym for New Economic Order. And this is a group in developed economies in particular that are the high spending, frequently spending consumers. We've developed an algorithm a few years ago, as you pointed out, to identify who was it in the economy who was the most valuable. And we ended up identifying this classification, this group. So these people are They earn more, but more importantly, they spend more. Earning isn't a really good determinant of future spending behaviour. So you need to know that these people have spending propensity, and that's what we identified. So there's 4.7 million of these NEOs in Australia, 64 million of them in the US. They are the socially progressive, typically. They're typically very well educated. They believe as much in learning a living as they do in earning a living. They're great planners and they're architects of their own life outcomes. They're people like you and me, Paul. They have lists.
Yes, very long lists.
They're very optimistic about the future and they juggle an intellectual bent with the desire to, change the world. They're conspicuous activists, but they're inconspicuous consumers. And one thing that's interesting, just to finish this first bit, you're born a NEO and you die a NEO. The opposite of a NEO is what we call traditional consumers. And there are 10 million of them in Australia. And you're born one and you die one. There's no migration between the two types.
So I can't aspire to be a NEO, Ross. I am what I am.
You can aspire to be more like a NEO, if you like, right. But ultimately when the going gets tough, you will revert to type.
And it's interesting, we're going to delve a bit deeper into this, but you mentioned the traditionals, which is the sort of the antithesis, I guess, of the NEOs. Just to sort of whet the listener's appetite, we're talking here about sort of the behaviour of traditional behaviour, which is most what most brands and marketers are playing to at the moment, which is sort of discounting, some of the rational benefits and discounting and price off. That's sort of essentially, have I got that right or am I messing with your archetype?
No, there's two crucial bits in what you just said. The first one is about behaviour. A lot of people believe that past behaviour is the best predictor of future behaviour. The algorithm that I've created with 194 different factors in it has 82 attitudinal factors. And they're there because it's attitudes and values that determine our future behaviour, not past behaviour. It's not about where someone went last week. It's about where they'd really love, where they desire to go next week. And that's really the predictive modelling that we do. So the difference is can be measured in behaviour for all that. To come back to your question, you know, the NEOs spend more frequently, as I said at the beginning, than anyone else, whereas the traditionals are very reluctant spenders. The 10 million people with a traditional mindset, and this is mindset modelling, the traditionals with a very, with a very traditional mindset are very reluctant spenders, even the wealthy ones. So only 6% of them are in the top third of elective spenders in the economy, whereas 90% of NEOs, 90% compared to 6%, are in the top third of elective spenders in the economy.
The final point here, Ross, before we come back to you, we'll get through some of the other panellists, is I think, and I'm sorry if I'm going to stuff this figure up, but I think upwards of 70% of discretionary spend or elective discretionary spending is coming from NEOs. Have I butchered that?
No, you've got it perfectly.
Okay, so it's quite significant. They are driving, you know, a big, big element of discretionary spending in the market.
It is significant. Of course, a lot of marketers believe that the entire world is designed and operates for traditionals. So, you know, they have the traditional value proposition, which estranges NEOs. So, you know, they really have to start aligning their brands with the high-value, high-spending consumers.
Scott Browning, you're a big advocate or a believer in the NEO strategy. At your time at JB Hi-Fi, it was big for you. You deployed it. You deployed a strategy there. I'm interested in what you did there. It's not something that I would have thought was sort of in JB Hi-Fi's sweet spot to target the high-end, big discretionary spenders. What did you do around NEOs at JB? You're doing it again at Jaguar now where you are, but what did you do at JB and why? And welcome, Scott.
Yeah, well, the challenge at JB when we started, it was very much a nascent business. It was just gone to a public company, had 20 stores, committed to the market that it was going to do 100-plus stores. In our minds, in the background, we had a target of around about 200 stores. So, and at the time, it was a music retailer.
Right. So this is what, 2005, mid-2000s then, was it, Scott?
2003, okay. 2004. Yep. And so a lot was happening in that industry. My background was at Kodak, so I saw what disruption does to businesses, you know, from the technological side. So being ready for it. So the key for any brand, especially on that growth cycle, is how do you differentiate but remain relevant and grow profitably, especially when you're going to roll out 200 stores off the back of a card. So, you know, it was important that we understood, we knew JB Hi-Fi had something called the X Factor. It was a distinctive brand, there was something going on there, but there was a lot of mythology in the business on who its customer was. People were searching for, who was the JB Hi-Fi customer? Was it a 55-year-old guy from Dandenong that wanted to buy a plasma TV, or was it, you know, some emo in the city that spent a lot of money on music? But back in those days, there was, retailers didn't have a lot of data on their customers. And when you looked at primary research, to Ross's point, the vast majority of respondents come from the volume of the population, but they might not have been the high lifetime value customers. And so we were somewhat desperate to find something that we could build data and strategy around. And it was just purely by accident we come across NEOs. And then we were able to run the NEO profile across our business to discover, you know, about 45% of our customers come up as the NEO group. And they're only 25% of the population.
You were over-indexing then.
Massive over-index. So then you do the formulation on value. They could be upwards of about 80% of value. And that makes a lot of sense, you know, that people who are spending, dropping $5,000 or at those days, about $8,000 on a plasma TV, they're not cheapskates.
Right.
But they're looking for value when, you know, once they decided what brand of TV to buy, well, they don't want to pay a premium for that. They want to pay the premium for the product, but as a retailer, it's a different challenge. But you still have to be relevant to those consumers. So NEOs, you know, we're looking at it through a keyhole. And NEOs open the door, and you're just able to walk out and have a really good look around. And it really transformed, because it debunked a lot of mythology about who our customers were, what they wanted. So we could have the same mindset in a Dandenong as we did in Camberwell, or, you know, in the Sydney parlance, you know, Parramatta versus Bondi Junction. As to Ross's say, we were looking for a mindset that responded to the business. So therefore, we're able to say, well, okay, a lot of the things that the business were doing might have been strong cues towards traditionals. And you don't want to throw that baby out with the bathwater. But for NEOs to grow and to develop and evolve in a technological space, we had to be ultra sensitive to the NEO mindset, because in 7 years' time, you know, the business was going to look very different. So we had to go on that journey with them. It was very clear that these people, you know, valued certain things, and we just had to stay on top of it. We didn't want to relegate the traditionals, but the NEOs were obviously at the core of everything we did. And then that really opened it up in everything from store size to assortment strategy in terms of categories that we weren't even in, that we had to get in and dominate within 10 years, shaped everything.
So you JB jumped in hook line. I mean, it was all in the deep end. It was all in on this.
Well, NEO provided us with the statistical support to the intuition that we had around it. You know, you've got to go in it. You know, we had some very intuitive retailers running that business. There's no question about it. I was very fortunate to be just a steward of the brand and during that time. But it illuminated certain factors that provided the data or statistical support to the strategy that we're able to turn back to time and time again. Over my 12-year period, we constantly return back to the data around this group in confirming decisions, because you might have been in the middle of something and not quite knowing whether you're on the right track. So, and these are times when retailers didn't have customer data. You know, it's just you were flying by sight all the time. There was no instrumentation on the dashboard.
Right.
So you had to go to something deeper, but it reduced the amount of dataless debate on who our customers was. As a retailer, I mean, demographics are just a joke. You're better off with star signs, because demography is just geography.
What is your star sign anyway, Scott?
I don't really want to throw it out.
I don't want to go there.
You can probably guess what it is.
Yeah, that's what.
So demography, you know, if a retailer's going to, their demographics are going to be where their store are. You plonk a store in Dandenong, you're going to have different demographics than you have in Camberwell.
Well, I want to come back to that conversation about whether you can do both. And you know, you're right, I would have put JB into a traditionalist or a traditional sort of primary segmentation. Before we get to that, I just want to ask you, you're at Jagged now. Are you deploying a NEO strategy there, or how does that look? Because it's a very different sort of business that you're in now.
Well, yeah, the philosophy is, to the extent that any business that ignores NEOs in their trajectory ignores them at their peril.
So the answer is yes, you're in it.
Yes, yes, we're in it.
Right.
You know, there are subtleties to everything, and you've got to be very careful about rules, you know, or, you know, you've got to have guidelines, you've got to have structures. But when you're a retailer, you're playing a different game than if you're a brand. So difference between a Volvo and a direct-to-customer retailer. And then there's lots of businesses that sit in between that, you know, like an insurance company versus, you know, a car company versus someone that deals direct to consumer, that somebody that mediates their business through custodians like retailers and things. There's lots of different dynamics to this in terms of what a NEO wants from a destination per se.
Just very quickly, how has business been for Jagged in the last 12 months? Maybe for those that don't know, explain a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, because of the NEO strategy around Jagged, Jagged was about a business 70% wholesale 12 months ago, pre-COVID.
To fashion retail outlets.
Yeah, say Myer, Iconic, these type of businesses. So 70, 80% of that business. And then they had a store, which was a traditional sort of location. And then probably, you know, 10 or 15% of its business was direct to customer in that space. So the strategy for Jagged, using the NEO guideline, is they had to move more of its business direct to customer. That's what the customer wanted in order to control the brand as an experience brand, which was always same as JB Hi-Fi. Customer experience, you need to control far more of the parameters if you're going to talk to a NEO and be successful.
Right.
COVID was a godsend in one respect, because every single wholesaler cancelled all their orders.
Right.
And Jagged was sitting on all the stock. With a strategy to move in that direction, or, you know, have a bigger share of the pie, and so within the space of 3 weeks, we'd closed our store, had no wholesalers, had a truckload of stock that we had to move, so we moved to 100%.
Right.
I guess the big thing with NEOs is what we learned at JB was the concept of reciprocal trust. Businesses say, oh, I want people to trust me, and yet they go around not trusting their customers. So how can you get your customer to trust you if you send them signals that you don't trust them? Things that might not seem critical at the time, but after they experience the brand, they become very loyal. We put a lot of emphasis on return policy to create a great experience. That's really what it comes down to.
I'm going to come back to really fascinating stuff and fascinating the transformation of Jagged from, as you say, wholesale to direct to consumer and ready to go. Love to dig into that a bit more. Hey, so Jonathan, you're ex Moët Hennessy in marketing. It makes sense, I guess, you know, everything we've heard so far, that Neos would be a primary target at a luxury group like that. Did it work?
It did, and it worked incredibly well. And it depends on sort of what you use as metrics for what works well. But for an LVMH, the task was make sure you deliver on your short-term business objective and critically make sure you maximize long-term value growth. And you do that whilst retaining your margin. And so to be able to do that over a 10-year period using Neos, and you know, using those metrics, yeah, it worked exceptionally well. What I did learn, and I learned very quickly, was that this wasn't just about buying an audience. This, and it comes back a little bit to what Scott's just saying, it's understanding the mindset of the Neo and then helping all your partners across the entire route to market to make sure that you meet and exceed those customer, those Neo expectations at every touch point all the time. And therefore, whether that be a creative partner, and Nick will talk a little bit about that, but do your creative partners absolutely understand and Neos and their value expectations? And critically, for us, with Moët Hennessy, a large proportion of our sales were through Dan Murphy's, through Vintage Cellars. Therefore, how do you help them as partners deliver on what they want to do, which is to create the maximum value for their most valuable customers? And so I quickly learned that it was making sure that we helped everybody across every touch point understand a Neo as best as possible.
Jonathan, was there any, I mean, the primary market would be Neos though for some of those, for the luxe brands, right? So was there traditionals that buy that portfolio?
Yeah, absolutely. You can have some very wealthy individuals who don't spend a lot and they have a traditional mindset. They might come in and they might buy Veuve Clicquot when it was on special in Dan Murphy's 1 week, and then maybe a couple of weeks later they come in and buy Mumm. I was particularly interested in the consumer that actually really desired a brand, for example, let's take Veuve Clicquot, and they desired all the value that was built into a brand like Veuve Clicquot, not only its quality, but the positioning it had in terms of maybe supporting business women, the way it was brought to life around the world, and to desire and be part of the lifestyle of Veuve Clicquot, I was interested in that consumer more so than the one that bought me on special once a week.
Right. Now, you're now advising other companies at premium, Jonathan, on Neos. What are you seeing from brands in the market at the moment? What have they done through COVID around this? Have they done anything? And what's going on into the next year or so?
I always think it's good to learn from the best. So my starting point is always to sort of look to what luxury is doing and then say, what can we learn from luxury? And if you look at what the luxury brands have been doing over the last 12 months, first of all, they've been putting their customers and their employees at sort of as their priority. And therefore, if they've had to try and convert perfume lines to creating sanitization, great, they'll do that as quickly as possible. But critically, with their brands, they've been doing what they always do. And that is to make sure that they reinforce the provenance and authenticity of their brand, and constantly recreating and innovating. And in essence, trying to find that point of timelessness where you really are true to your origins, but always fresh. So they've been highlighting their craftsmanship. They've been continuing their creative partnerships. And so they've continued to do what luxury brands do exceptionally well. All the time.
Great. Now, Nick Cleaver, you're another backer of Neos. I think you're a fan of the whole notion. How are you using them and how widespread is the understanding of this whole segmentation, if you like, although Ross will wrap me over the knuckles for calling it a segment, I think. So I'll take that back. But what's your take on Neos and your clients, how are they using it, Nick? Is there some interesting things going on in your world?
Yeah, perhaps I'll start by answering that by talking about why we see it as immensely relevant to our business and how we see its application. All marketers and advertisers face one overriding huge challenge, which is we're in a battle for attention. And in this, you know, increasingly complex media, always on media world in which we live, how do you engage brands with people in the most meaningful way? And in that sense, I think NEOs are immensely helpful. They're incredibly useful in terms of bringing together the core disciplines of an agency. Now, we've got an agency model that brings data, creative and media thinking together. And you know, that's increasingly becoming the trend. There are different disciplines within our agency whereby we see NEOs as a common thread that can link those disciplines together and then actually help us target the people we want to target as we go into market with performance marketing. So I think one of the attributes about NEO thinking that we haven't talked about yet is that it's not just a database, it's not just a philosophy, but it comes with a holistic piece of thinking that actually helps you build creative content which is appealing. So if you talk to our ECD and our creative guys, they would see NEO thinking as something which is very liberating and inspiring. Ross will talk about NEOs being drawn to things that, you know, that are engaging, intelligent, that treat NEOs in a way that acknowledges their intelligence, that's entertaining. So there are guidelines for creating content that comes out of NEO thinking, and then that also then translates into where, when, and how you actually place that content in the marketplace. So I see NEO thinking as a common thread that can connect our thinking from ideation right through to implementation. And I think that's really important for us as a business, and it's really important for our clients.
Examples, Nick, of where you're using this. Have you got any examples you can talk about of where it's worked or hasn't even?
You know, we are working with Ross and the team at the moment in terms of operationalizing the data and implementing it. It's been, we are working with a large financial institution at the moment implementing the whole NEO piece in terms of the creative that we're developing and how we're going to market. I don't have the liberty of talking about who they are. It's also currently starting to be used by a couple of our other clients. So I don't have a neat package that I can actually put on the table in front of you and say, well, here is the case study. But it's certainly, I think from our point of view, it's influencing the way our business is operationalizing, and it's also beginning to influence some of our key clients. I think you can see, I mean, coincidentally, I think, and the reason why I think we were drawn to the whole NEO piece is that within our body of work that we currently have, I think, you know, there's almost a great deal of NEO thinking within our work, if in the past it was unknowing. So the work we do for Budget Direct or the work we do for Audi and clients like this, NEO thinking resonates really well with the work we've done in the past. And so we see it as a potential to enhancing our effectiveness going into the future.
Ross, Nick talked about how NEO's NEO strategy is influencing his creative, but also the media and the media choice and selection of how to find and message people and where they might be. NEO's media consumption. I mean, how do you find them when you know who they are and what they typify? But how do you find them?
So NEOs are on pretty much every media agency's database. If they subscribe to Roy Morgan, then they have it in their database. They just can't see it. So when there's a commercial arrangement, we flick a switch and it turns on. So it's totally operationalized across all media, from traditional media right through to programmatic. So you can actually target and buy them really anywhere in the entire media ecosystem. That's taken years. That's been a really, really big job of NEO 2.0. You mentioned that this goes back 15 years. It's really only in the last couple of years that we've totally reconfigured the algorithm and all of this particularly digital-ready Neo operational capabilities.
What a wonderful plug I just got. That was a window fitter plug there, Ross. Well done.
Yes, thank you.
the interesting bit though there is their media consumption behaviour different?
Their media consumption is dramatically different from traditional. So traditionals, if we take big generalities, traditional skew towards particularly television, radio. Whereas Neos do everything. You know, they do more of everything all the time. But they are really deeply embedded in the online. So this is a kind of a natural play. They skew heavily towards online with everything they do. They pretty much live their lives online and have been doing so for many years. That said, there are some really interesting media channels that they do choose, and one of them is cinema. When cinemas are open, they really like cinema. They like magazines, you know. So there are some kind of quirky things in there as well, as the obvious.
Scott, I want to come back to this theme earlier about can a brand or a company do both and talk to neos and traditionals. What is the risk there, or what is the tension in doing that? And can everyone do it? So can every company have a neo strategy even if they're talking to traditionals?
Yeah, so this is purely from a retailer's point of view. The answer is yes. If you're a premium position brand already, you know, like a Veuve Clicquot or whatever, it's slightly more complicated than that. But in terms of why people use a brand, a retailer is really, people expect certain things. So you still have to deliver what people expect before you even get started. So, and in JB Hi-Fi's case, we as a retailer with many stores, and in those days, 99% of your business was coming from the store, 100% even, wouldn't matter what your advertising campaign was, what happened in store was critical to your long-term success. The store environment was pretty much neo-focused in terms of how you narrated that store. There's an orchestration of a narrative in terms of a journey throughout the store that increased dwell time, for example, improved engagement, was entertaining. Neos value sort of three things, I think, really well. They value art in a form that, you know, where art brings luster and conviction to purpose, as I sometimes say. They value authenticity, and they value that trust factor. But you have to look at it in as those things are just negative concepts. They're negative concepts in a sense, they don't really exist. They exist through the absence or presence of something else. So trust is really a lack of distrust. That authenticity is a lack of something that isn't there, so no sort of personality of a brand. And, I mean, it's hard to say what art is, but when it's not there, it's very obvious. There's no energy. There's no, so we had stores with staff, we said, yeah, we had handwritten tickets, but they create their own signs. And they just we just worked on non-negotiable don'ts. Rather than do all of this, we just said, just don't do this. This is what we're not.
Today's JB Hi-Fi environment, the stores, has anything has it changed today, or is it the same? They're continuing with that?
Yeah.
So the sense when you get in there into a JB Hi-Fi is, you're right, you've got handwritten posters, and it still seems to me, and this is where you open to correction, it seems like you go in there, it's a very retail environment where it's there's offers and it's not slick. It's almost the opposite to slick. That's okay to a neo.
I mean, if it's authentic.
Right.
And it's good for a traditional, because there's no cognitive dissonance with the fact that I'm going to get a deal here, or this is what they expect. However, you know, Apple have invested, or JB Hi-Fi and Apple have invested $150,000 in an Apple display.
Right.
But it's sort of incorporated in the narrative in the right positioning. The concept of curation was a big development in the brand story in terms of how do you leverage that. And you had the emergence of brands like Apple that understood the concept of curation and customer experience, and you're able to work with them. Our biggest competitor shunned Apple at the time because they were a low margin.
Right. Okay.
I mean, Paul, I would say that when you asked the question about how you manage neos and traditionals, are they mutually exclusive? I think there's a parallel piece of thinking when you look at Binet and Field's study about brand building versus short-term promotion. And in a sense, I think there's a similarity here, which is probably the answer for most mass marketers is you you don't want to exclude a very large, important client base, albeit they may not be NEOs. But when you look at Binet and Field's work, you could say that brand building, brand narrative piece of work that engages people is so important for NEOs. But as Binet and Field say, we're not ignoring the fact there are imperatives on occasions, if it's a 60-40 split, as they suggest, that you actually use retail price-driven promotion to actually drive volume. So I think there's a little bit of a parallel there for me.
Mm. And Ross, you talk a lot about the fact that brand is actually the critical differentiator here for NEOs versus anything else.
Yes, I do. Before I do that, I just want to say one thing, and that is that there's a business rule when it comes to the NEO mindset, and that is that traditionals will go where NEOs go, but NEOs are very reluctant to go where traditionals go. So any business that's interested in attracting NEOs is much better to start with a very NEO value proposition, because it'll bring the traditionals along as well. In terms of brand, one of the things that's really important to understand is that the past probably 3, 4, even 5 years, there's been this rush to the bottom of the purchase funnel and complete obsession with activation at the bottom of the funnel and ROI, whereas we're starting to forget the investment in the brand, and that's a road to nowhere. One of the things that's interesting about the NEOs is that they shorten the distance between the top of the funnel and the bottom of the funnel. So the distance between brand building at the top and actual sale activation at the bottom is much shorter with the NEO. They just take a whole lot of steps. And this comes down to a simple principle. Everyone wants the best price. Everyone wants the best price. But for the traditional consumers, the 10 million traditional consumers in Australia, it always starts and ends with price. But for NEOs, price is just the cost of falling in love. And if you can't get them to fall in love with your brand at the top of the funnel, you'll never get to the bottom.
How does that land, Nick, when you talk to your clients about this? What is the resistance? And Ross and I were talking about it the other day. The primary resistance from brands and marketers to deploy a NEO strategy. There is pushback, right? Because not everyone's doing it. Well, certainly not everyone's talking about it, at least, anyway.
Yeah, look, I think many clients have invested a great deal of money in building their own databases, or they are already attached to different typologies. And I think so there's already investment that's gone into a way of thinking and a segmentation of the market that they may have been using to actually drive their business. And so they may see the NEO data, NEO thinking is as perhaps, you know, a different segmentation that's not appropriate to them. I mean, my perspective on that is that actually you can take a NEO database. It doesn't mean that you can't layer in and filter other screens across it, depending on what category you're in. So I think some clients perhaps believe it's an all or nothing strategy, and maybe, you know, Ross would say it is, but I think there's an ability to actually take NEO thinking and NEO data, and then look at what data you have within your own organization, and then obviously finding out how many NEOs are in your primary database, in your primary data, is, you know, an interesting starting point. But there are ways of actually, I think, which many clients don't understand, that you can actually bring together different pieces of data to actually enhance the relevance of this to your particular category.
We've got probably three questions to get through, and we'll wind up, because suddenly, and I've realised we're out of time. But Ross, there's a great anecdote that you talk about in your conversation with David Thodey, who was then CEO of Telstra, about segmentation and how they were dealing with it. You've also got some broader thoughts on segmentation, because it can mess with a lot of companies when they try to think about a NEO deployment.
Yeah, David was just brilliant in that when he heard about the NEO thing, he said to me, so what you're saying, Ross, is we've got these 6 or 8 needs-based segments.
This is at Telstra?
This is at Telstra, and they were really, really smart segments. You know, it was a really smart segmentation. And we've got a different value proposition for each of them. That's a lot of expense and a lot of effort. What you're saying is that instead of the six or eight vertical ones, you can do a horizontal run across all of those segments. So we don't throw our segments out. We keep our segments, but you can identify the proportion of NEOs in each segment, and we can do one NEO value proposition across all of those segments, as a horizontal slice. Is that right? And I said, yes. And he gave us their lowest value needs-based segment, these very smart segments, and said, go and see if you can find any hidden value there. And we modelled the process and found $80 million of hidden value in that. That's how it works with segments. So this is not a segmentation. It's a mindset. It's a piece of data science that is segment agnostic.
What about personalization? How does it fit into this? Because obviously we've got a lot of, the next question is around CX, but we have a lot of investment in thinking and time and budget going into personalization strategies. What does that mean for NEOs, Ross?
Well, you have to have hyper-personalization with NEOs. And that really means that every single leader in marketing, every CMO, needs to really think about this as a kind of Casanova strategy. Casanova wasn't, that attractive. Word is he wasn't even that good a lover. He just made every woman feel like she was the only woman in the world. And that's the principle. That's the guideline for dealing with NEOs.
What does this mean for customer experience then, Scott? Because there's so many big platforms, and I want Jonathan and Nick's view on this really quickly as well, is there's so many, there's big platforms that are out there sort of doing generic customer experience, journey mapping for customers and so forth. Can they actually carve out and do it differently, or do you talk to the NEOs and the traditionals to be happy, which is what Ross talked about earlier?
You can start going very granular on this stuff, but you can make a lot of mistakes then with NEOs. If you get it wrong, you spoil the recipe in a way. So if you step back from it one step to use the Casanova process, it's about at least displaying empathy to the other, is that it comes down to that reciprocal trust issue, but it's putting in front of them solutions and things that they really need in the space. That can be very generic in a sense of an offer. And it doesn't disenfranchise traditionals. So it's very important that you don't alienate this audience if you want to grow and differentiate. So you can't make the mistake of tactics that might work with a traditional thinking that, it's going to play out. Some people try to, it's like if you get an over-personalised message but they've completely missed the mark, you can get into, people go, well, obviously they don't know what they're doing. They're just guessing on this. So, and that can affect everything from performance marketing to retargeting issues. That people don't like to be retargeted if they've already bought the product.
Nick, the implications for customer experience and CX and that whole tech platform stuff that goes on. You got any thoughts there?
Gosh, in the last 12 months with COVID, we've seen an explosion of the whole online world and brands going online. And I think. The great watch out for brands is the parity experience that many people experience from going from one brand to another. And there's a generic online, for some companies, there's a generic online experience. And I think therefore, using NEO thinking and the prompt it gives you to develop unique, relevant, inspiring experiences online is a great prompt for marketers to think, how can I make the genuine brand experience that we've got, for this brand come to life in a special way for us online? So I think it helps develop unique online experiences and get us away from a very generic sense that feeling that we get at the moment.
Yeah, and it is very generic, and I think that's sort of that's part of the promise of technology, right? Is to scale and sort of broad sweeping stuff. So if there's some nuance in the customer experience, it's welcomed. Jonathan, to wrap this up, I'll ask each of you, what should marketers be prioritising for 2021, certainly in the context of the conversation we've just had? Your thoughts for what have we got left? 10 months left? Crikey, we're in March nearly already.
First of all, absolutely be customer value obsessed. So from a NEO's perspective, we know that hyperlocal is increasingly important. We know that authenticity and provenance is, as always, incredibly important in terms of value and evaluation. Ultimately, maximize anticipation and critically, constantly, through your partners, through your route to market, through your communications, deliver on the moments of truth and exceed expectations wherever possible.
Scott, your advice to your peers and on the marketing side, the brand side?
Yeah, okay. I come back to that. It's quite a perennial thing, but it's that customer experience. It's really, and in the digital world, it's all about friction, you know, in terms of...
Well, getting rid of it.
Yeah, it needs to be seamless and elegant.
Right.
In a way to focus on and... You know, Nick made a really good point. You know, if I go back to JB days, the Neo opened up who our real competitors were. And our real competitors were people like Qantas or restaurants or new cars, cinemas. And if you look at recent results for people like JB Hi-Fi, all those competitors were shut down and they've doubled their profit, for example.
Right.
In the GFC, people stopped buying cars and a bit of overseas travel. JB Hi-Fi profits surged. You know, it's sort of a case of, who are your real competitors when you're a Neo? It comes down to businesses that provide a great customer experience. And today, your value as a brand, your perception as a brand, is not measured by your category competitor. If you're getting a great online experience with JB Hi-Fi and you go to a Bunnings and you don't get a great online experience or a different thing, you're going to devalue the Bunnings brand versus the JB Hi-Fi brand. And you're going to ask questions about, do they really care about giving me a great experience at all my different touch points? I mean, Bunnings have done a great job of that in the last 12 months, for example, and they're kicking goals. But at Jagged, you know, we also sort of say, well, you know, we've got to measure our brand against a Netflix, for example, or an Uber, because people are having these great low-friction experiences. So instead of delivering clothes and those type of things, that's what we're focused on, is constantly removing friction and making less mistakes too, and getting our customers to put up with it.
Great points. Nick, final words of wisdom in terms of priorities for this year?
Well, I think marketers are on a journey whereby they are endeavouring to harmonise the competing interests of data created in media. And I think the more they harmonise the thinking that runs through their marketing operations, the more effective they'll be in actually delivering brand experiences up to their customers that are really meaningful, authentic and compelling. So I don't think there's any dramatic step change going on in 21, but coming out of a recession, coming out of COVID, I think the smarter you are in using data, using perhaps neo thinking to harmonize your data, creative and media thinking, could deliver better results for you.
And the final words, thanks Nick, the final observations to Ross. Big tip for 2021 for brands?
My hope is that 2021 will be the year when the C-suite recognises that there is not just one market and that there are two fundamentally different markets with two fundamentally different types of consumers with totally different mindsets. It's time to stop talking about the market. It's time to stop talking about the consumer and start talking about nuanced views to unlock hidden value.
It makes entirely common sense, but then we don't necessarily operate like that as humans, do we, Ross?
We do increasingly. One of the things that I do know is that when you're dealing with the C-suite in particular, they're weak in the face of evidence. They're weak in the face of data science. When they see the data science, they start to recognise that the world is not how they saw it before, and they all, as an organisation, have to think differently about it.
Ross Honeywill, Scott Browning, Jonathan Coles, Nick Cleaver, thank you. Great conversation, really insightful, and I think I want to be a Neo when I grow up. So stay safe, gents, and we'll follow this up. Thank you. MI3 Audio Edition was presented by Paul McIntyre, that's moi, producer Nick Slater, music by Matt Dwyer. For more episodes, go to podcastone.com.au or search MI3 Audio Edition on Apple Podcasts and hit the subscribe button. Listener.